Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Public Unions Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 30th, 2014, the Supreme Court issued its opinion in Harris v. Quinn. The central question in this case concerned whether a state can, consistent with the First and 14th Amendments to the Constitution, compel in-home care providers paid for through Medicare, also known as personal assistants or PAs, to financially support a union to be their exclusive representative with respect to employment-related collective bargaining. In an opinion delivered by Justice Alito, the court held by a vote of 5-4 that the First Amendment prohibits the collection of an agency from PAs who do not want to join or support the union. Chief Justice Roberts, as well as Justices Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas, joined the opinion of the court. Justice Kagan wrote a dissenting opinion, joined by Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor. The decision of the Seventh Circuit was reversed in part, affirmed in part, and remanded. To discuss the case, we have Andrew Grossman, who is an associate at Baker & Hostetler LLP and an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Grossman.
Harris v. Quinn, I think, promises to be one of the most consequential decisions of this past term, and perhaps it may be the most important in terms of its immediate effects and the long-term doctrinal consequences. To make things easy, I'll begin by discussing the legal and factual background for the case, and then offer a few thoughts about what I think it all means. Now, to begin with, Harris works really on two different levels. There's what the court held and what it signaled about the future of public sector unions and public workers' First Amendment rights. Now, the court has long held that the First Amendment's protections of freedom of speech and freedom of association include freedom from government coercion to speak, freedom from coerced support of another person's speech, and freedom from coerced associations. So the question is when, if ever, can a state require that workers channel their speech regarding matters of public interest through a labor union? When can they be forced to pay to support a labor union speech on those issues? And when can they be forced to associate with that union? Now, in a 1977 case called Abood v. Detroit Board of Education, the court held that the state could force its own workers to do those things because it has a compelling interest in maintaining labor peace and the subsidiary need to avoid free riders. That is, workers who receive the benefits of collective bargaining without paying for union representation. Labor peace, the court explained, encompasses all the difficulties of having to negotiate and reach agreement with a wide variety of workers who might hold a wide variety of potentially irreconcilable views on how the workplace ought to be run. Instead, a government employer can negotiate with just a single labor union, which would then represent all workers, whether or not all of those workers agreed with it on every particular issue or not. Now, for this to work, the union has to represent every single worker, and it has to do so neutrally, without discriminating against workers who do not join the union. Those non-members can therefore be required to pay a so-called agency fee to the union to cover its collective bargaining expenses. But the big question in Harris, is somewhat narrower. What happens when the workers at issue don't really look like state employees at all? Can the state still require them to support a labor union? In 2003, the state of Illinois decided to recognize home care workers receiving subsidies through its rehabilitation program as state employees, but only for purposes of collective bargaining. The law is actually quite clear that they're not considered to be state employees for any other purposes, such as receiving state worker benefits or even subjecting the state to liability for their actions. The law is also clear that the state is not responsible for hiring, firing, or supervising these workers, for controlling the facilities in which they work, which are, after all, in many instances, the workers' own homes, or even for evaluating their performance. Those things are all done either by the recipients of the home care or by their guardians. The state recognized the SEIU, a labor union, as these workers' exclusive representative, and so now they have to pay the union to bargain with the state over the very narrow range of things that the state actually does control, basically just wages, and those are set in any case by law. About a dozen states have adopted similar requirements for home-based workers, including home health aides and child care workers, many of whom care for family members and receive modest subsidies from the state for doing so. Now, that was the subject of the precise ruling in Harris. According to the majority opinion, those kinds of requirements are, quote, a very substantial expansion of Abood's reach. What justifies the agency fee, the court explained, is the fact that a state compels the union to promote and protect the interests of non-members while it promotes labor peace through its collective bargaining activities. But in this instance, the union has precious little authority to bargain because the state controls so very few aspects of the employment relationship. The major one that it does control, pay, is set by statute. And as the court explains, if these workers could be made to associate with and to support a union, so could every recipient of state subsidies. And Abood's reasoning doesn't extend anywhere near that far. Moreover, generally applicable First Amendment principles prohibit the government from forcing individuals to fund the speech of other private speakers, absent some compelling government interest. But as the court observes, even if collective bargaining by an exclusive representative like a labor union is necessary to achieve labor peace, it's far from clear that that requires that all employees join the union or pay union fees. Indeed, federal workers, postal service workers, and workers in so-called right-to-work states get to choose whether or not to join or to support a labor union. And the result, needless to say, has not exactly been chaos. As with home workers, it's not even apparent that there's any labor peace interest here at all. There's no common workplace, no common job assignments, and little possibility of the kind of industrial discord that underlies the whole idea of labor peace and that motivated union membership requirements to begin with. So the bottom line, according to the majority, is that the state of Illinois may not require its home care workers to pay fees to a labor union, although of course they may choose to do so. Now, that's what the court held, but equally notable is what it did not hold, and that's whether or not Abood remains good precedent. The court could avoid answering that question because of its holding that the workers here are not state employees at all. At the same time, the majority devotes a substantial portion of its opinion to describing what it calls, quote, Abood's questionable foundations. Five justices now have signed on to the view that Abood was wrong as originally decided, that it's inconsistent with First Amendment doctrine in the court's case law, and that it is unworkable in practice because of the enormous practical difficulties of protecting the First Amendment rights of workers who disagree with the labor union. Now, these objections aren't arbitrary ones. They track the criteria that the court typically applies in deciding whether or not to overrule one of its precedents. Now, that is, it seems to me, certainly not an accident. So where does this leave us? Now, over the past decade, about a dozen states or so have enacted requirements similar to the one in Illinois, declaring home care workers to be state employees for purposes of collective bargaining and for union representation. This was a key area of growth for labor unions, and it was expected to help them offset continuing membership declines in the private sector. From around about a zero a decade ago, several hundred thousand home care workers now are covered by collective bargaining agreements. After Harris, many of those workers will be able to choose whether or not to financially support a labor union. Now, that's not going to happen overnight. There's going to be litigation, and states and unions will argue that their programs are materially different and that Harris doesn't apply. The full results of Harris could take a few years to shake out, and in many instances, labor unions will continue to represent home care workers whom they already do as workers choose to accept that representation. Other workers will choose that they do not care to continue paying for that sort of representation. But I think one thing is clear is that this will slow, if not end outright, future state-based programs targeting home care workers. These were premised on the type of arrangement that states like Illinois had adopted, and now that arrangement seems in general to be off the table. The bigger question is what is the fate of Abood and its continuing relevance in labor law? Harris strongly suggests that Abood is not long for this world, and I think that's right so long as the court retains its current composition. Harris was a warning shot. In the same way that the court's campaign finance decision in Wisconsin Right to Life prefigured Citizens United, and in the same way that its voting rights decision in Northwest Austin prefigured the results in Shelby County. This has been a hallmark of the Roberts Court, signaling to give the ability to the democratic process to work things out, as well as for the law to fall into line, signaling its view on broader legal questions that it may choose to reach in subsequent cases. I think the interesting thing here is that the end of Abood, which is to say the end of coercing public workers to support labor unions, may actually come sooner than many people expect. Currently pending before the Ninth Circuit is a case called Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association, and it directly raises the question of whether Abood remains good law. The plaintiffs in that case are public school teachers, and there is no way to avoid the central question of Abood's continuing relevance. there is no opportunity for a narrower ruling. After all, the plaintiffs in Abood were also public school teachers. Friedrichs isn't moving fast enough to make it to the Supreme Court for the next term, the 2014 term, which begins this coming October. But it should in all likelihood be ready in the next year, in the subsequent year. That means we could see a final decision regarding Abood's continued relevance by June 2016, just 2 short years from now. My view is that the court's doubts are well-founded. The court's precedents didn't really support the results in Abood, and that's something that's well recounted by the Harris majority. More to the point, the kind of paternalistic impulse underlying the holding in Abood is something that the court in recent decades has rejected in a series of cases in many different domains, from commercial speech to associational rights cases. As the court has focused more diligently and more technically developed its First Amendment doctrine, these different strands have become apparent, and at this point it's fairly clear that Abood is a bit of an outlier. The more difficult question is where this leaves private sector union arrangements such as the Railway Labor Act, the National Labor Relations Act, and that's a difficult question, and I think the court in Harris went to some length and took great pains to suggest that this may be something that applies only in the public sector and that really only Abood is at risk. I think the doctrinal developments we'll see in coming years will indicate whether or not that's the case.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.